The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. Although it's an EDU show, it's going to be a Q&A style EDU show, as we promised you. Last week, we did one with an LTC long-term care slant, had Greg on. This week, we're going to take a tax focus to our questions that are going to appear on the EDU show today. And we've invited our good friend and colleague, Bob, to the show. Once again, he's been on before. So welcome back, Bob.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back, Chris and Jim.
Yeah. It's always a pleasure, and hopefully the end of your tax planning year is winding down appropriately. You're probably still in the mix of things here as we record this. There's only a couple weeks left, and a lot of people know that tax season for tax prep, of course, is the early part of the year until April 15th for the most part, but there's a lot of tax planning that has to be done toward, before the calendar year ends. In circumstances like a lot of our retirees that we work with face. So I know you've been deep in that. So how's that winding down, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, no, it's been a busy, whole busy year, but busy right now with planning, and that's still going on. You know, by virtue of the end of the year, so, well, there's a, you know, like a light at the end of the tunnel, because that's going to kind of end things for the most part.
Right.
And then a nice January. I mean, January for tax folks is a quiet month, because planning's kind of wrapped up and too early to really prepare return. So that's going to be the break.
Yeah. So before I bring Jim on, I'm sure he's itching to say something, but so that we get it out there right away, since we are approaching the end of the year, we want to make sure to encourage people who have decided it makes sense for them to do a Roth conversion. The clock is ticking, and you need to take actions to get that to happen before the end of the year if you want it to count for the this tax year, which, of course, the tax year for individuals comes to an end here on December 31st, which is just now a couple of weeks away. So just wanted to remind everybody not to wait to the last minute. You're close to the last minute already, but if you've decided, and I'm not saying you should or shouldn't do it, that's going to depend on your personal circumstances. But what I am saying is, if you've decided you should do it and you want to do it, you better get a move on, because there's a lot of activity at the custodians this time of year, and it can sometimes take longer than you might expect to happen. So just want to give everybody a heads up so that they can't say that we didn't warn them. So now you can talk, Jim.
Oh, that's fine listening to you guys talk. That's usually how the shows go.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. You're really taking advantage of people who haven't been listening to the show for very long. You say that kind of stuff constantly, where our longtime listeners realize that I could talk for the next 500 shows with only me talking, and I'd probably just barely catch up to the number of words that you've used in the past on the show.
I'm doing what politicians do. I keep saying something over and over again, and eventually everyone believes it's real.
There you go. Well, you're being very effective in that, I think.
Why, thank you.
Sure.
But yes, we have Bob on. I'm very happy that he's on. This is our EDU version of, well, our Q&A versions of EDU shows through the month of December, a month that we intend to keep lighthearted and fun. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea, I hope. The good news is I haven't told anyone this. I didn't even tell you guys yet. Oh, wow. I have not been in AFib in 7 days.
Well, congratulations. Oh, yeah. That's good news.
Is that because you've been working out? You said you were going to start working out more.
I don't think it was that. In fact, I'm questioning if I should do the operation on January 4th. So I'm trying to get a hold of the doctor and the physician. There's my cardiologist who did the original ablation, and then he wants a new cardiologist to do the second one because my first ablation was heat. The second one's going to be freezing. Anyways, I don't know. I'm just sharing with everyone. Maybe I won't go under the knife on January 4th. I haven't been in 7 days. I probably jinxed me. Watch me go in tonight. But I'm so happy. I've gone 7 days without being in AFib. So yes. Pat myself on the back for that one. Whatever I'm doing seems
well, just
to
not
be
too
working.
Hard. You don't want to induce it.
Yeah. True. I don't want to induce it too much. All righty. Okay, we're ready to begin. The one thing is, Bob,
yes.
Greg almost let the bag out of the cat. The
bag out of the cat?
No, the other way around. The cat out of the bag today when he wished you good luck on the game show.
I was not sure what he meant by it, but Greg doesn't waste words.
You're
so
about to find out.
Something.
So there is a little game show that we're doing. I got my first negative review on it. They said to 86 it. It was not good.
No, right.
But that has to reflect.
But you're going
to
forge ahead and do it anyway.
I'm going to forge ahead because I've been proved it. The name of the game show, Bob, is Huh? So Chris and I truly do believe it will be the new game show when Wheel of Fortune and Pat Sajak retire.
Whoa, don't drag me into this.
So
what's Wheel of Fortune?
Wheel of Fortune, isn't that the wheel where you spin and win a fortune?
Whether you pick the letters and they flip them or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Wheel of Fortune. Yeah. And they get that blonde woman running around
Vanna White
and Pat Sajak. I mean, the two of them have been around since I've been a kid. My God. But anyways, people apparently still watch that show. So what is the game show, huh? There's only going to be three questions, but I've improved it because Greg and Chris totally blotched it last week. And I think you're going to win, Bob, for a couple of reasons. You're smarter than Chris, and I'm the official scorekeeper. So who I say wins. So just keep that in mind. Wink, wink. And we're going to go through the show.
And so I didn't do well last week, so.
No, Chris did lousy.
Yeah.
But so I borrowed it from football now. So you can get 7 points, 3 points, or 2 points. And whoever has the most points at the end wins. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm the official keeper of the score. So who I say wins. But that's how we get scores. Now, unlike football, we only play three quarters. We're not going to play four quarters. So just keep that part in mind. There's only going to be three quarters, which I guess is only not quite a full game, but we're going to play three words. And how this goes, Bob, is, you know, since my stroke, I don't write too well anymore. So I dictate a lot of what I want to write. And when I dictate into Microsoft, it doesn't really pick up what I'm saying. It doesn't hear too well. And it types weird things instead of the words coming out of my mouth. So I've been saving the words. And what I do is I say one of the words. For instance, last week, you'll probably nail this, Bob. Last week, Microsoft wrote call Paris. So that's the word Microsoft wrote, but I think it meant call Petty. There's a little hint there, Bob. Call Petty. I think that's what Microsoft thought I said. So I say call Paris, and you're going to try to guess, and Chris is going to try to guess the word I was actually trying to say. Okay. So with the word call Paris, can you guess what word I was trying to say?
This is just a practice one. We already did this.
This is a practice. I'm trying to explain the rules. So you would say a word and try to guess what it is. Then if you couldn't guess what it is, well, if you do, you get 7 points. So whoever, whichever one of you shouts it out first gets 7 points and a commanding lead in the game.
You're about to see why this went so poorly last week.
If neither of you can guess the word, then I will use it in a sentence. So the sentence for call Paris, Bob, or call Paris is, there are a call Paris of strategies to reduce taxes on Roth conversions. See how I tied that into taxes, Bob?
Mm-hmm, so I do.
There are a call Paris of strategies to reduce taxes on Roth conversions. If either one of you can now guess what the word is, you get 3 points. If you guys blew it on the 7 points and blew it on the 3 points, we got a 2-point conversion. And that's, I'm just going to start spelling the word. And the first one of you who can shout out the word before I fully spell it gets the 2 points. See how I've improved the rules, Chris?
We'll see.
Hey, Bob, can you figure out what call Petit was?
No, I can't. I mean, in all fairness to me, sometimes the regular words you say, I don't know what you're saying. So it's like a double contest in a way. Or yeah. But I'm willing to give it a shot. You know, I'm willing to give it a shot. Yeah.
Well, tell them what this one was.
The word was potpourri.
I wouldn't have gotten that.
Yeah, neither did I.
Okay.
Neither did Microsoft.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that the choice of words this time is a little bit easier to figure out, because Greg and I failed miserably last week.
You did. Now, the first word, there is no way in H-E-double-L's. Mm-hmm. Neither someone is it. You, one of you will get this word. There's just no doubt. One of you will walk away with 7 points, a commanding lead this early in the game, because this has to be the easiest going. Okay. So first thing is, I will say what Microsoft typed. It's two words. Microsoft typed two words.
Susan.
Excellent. Bob, I told you you were going to win.
Wait a minute. That was so easy. Last week, you gave us these weird, I mean, it's like foreign language. And now you give Susan? That's fair?
No, Susan. Bob clearly picked up the game.
Because my mind is thinking, it can't be that simple based on last week. Okay, congratulations, Bob, with your commanding lead. Now I see how he slanted it in your favor.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
I did slant in his favor. You could have shouted out, Susan. I told you one of you two would easily get word.
Okay.
I wasn't kidding.
Okay.
All right. The next word. Barber. Good try, but no. Chris, do you want to try for 7 points?
It said Barbara, like the
Barbara. B-A-R-B-R-A. Barbara.
I don't know.
All right. So now, for 3 points, I will use it in a sentence. Pay attention. Barbara, you able to help me answer a question tomorrow afternoon?
Bob, are you?
Excellent, Bob. Yes.
No, you can't use a contestant's name as one of them. That gives them an inherent advantage because they're used to hearing that over and over and over again. Okay, fine. I've already lost.
I think I'm up to 10. I know Jim's
so
the scorekeeper,
but
I think I have 10.
Now I can't win. It's fine. Congratulations, Bob. Can we end this now?
Is a mercy roll? Is that what you're asking for?
No, I vote for the 86.
Well, that was good. I wasn't sure that anybody would get that. Okay. Well, because it does include Bob's. Well, that's why I did it, because Bob's on the show. He's not on all the time. I thought having a word that involved him.
Put your thumb on the scale in favor of Bob. That's fine. I've only been on the show with you for like 8 years or so.
All right, wait, I'm not putting my finger on the scale. So what we'll do, this is a double, so to make it fair for Chris, just like they do on Family Feud, double or nothing, you know, double, all the values are doubled. So this is the final round.
Okay.
The values are doubled. So you still have a chance, Chris. You got to nail it right off the bat.
Okay.
But your 7 can become 14, which last time I checked is greater than Bob's 10.
Okay.
Okay. So values are doubled. The word is 2 words. Fat balls. Anybody going to shout out some guesses? Fat balls.
I have no idea.
I don't either.
Okay, well, we'll use it in a sentence. Mm-hmm. And
that's not what you were trying to say then.
No.
Well, no, why would I say fat balls? No, this is fat balls. That's what came out. All right. So I'll use it in a sentence, but Chris, words are now tripled. So you still wouldn't have a chance, but you at least wouldn't lose as horribly 9-10 okay. or 10-9 as you would 10-0.
Just give us a sentence so we can end this madness.
Okay. All right. Here's the sentence. Fat balls sending a copy of your death certificate to the plan custodian.
This game is horrible. What is it?
Is it a fax? Fax maybe something?
No. That involves sending a copy of your death certificate to the plan custodian.
Maybe, maybe Microsoft's telling you you mumble.
I said that involves and it typed fat balls. Hmm.
Well, clearly Microsoft is not using some type of context and as it tries to interpret what you're saying, because fat balls doesn't fit in any sentence you would usually use in a retirement planning business.
So, no, but that involves does. And apparently that involves sounds like fat balls to Microsoft. Okay. Well,
so all right. Thankfully this is over, right? We're not doing this ever again.
There's no overtime. We voided overtime.
Correct. Congratulations, Bob. You're the champion. Greg and I don't know if we scored any points at all, but that's okay.
No, you didn't.
I look forward to the day when we don't do this.
Hey, I'm trying to have fun in the month of December.
It's fun for you. Our listeners are agonizing over this.
Well, they can fast forward, but I'm sure at least one person played along at home. Okay. All right. So we've got tax-related questions, but as we normally try to do, we like to start with the new question of the week. Mm-hmm. And as luck would have it, we kind of got a tax-related question as the new question of the week. We got this in yesterday, as a matter of fact. So I kind of jumped it in and said, perfect, new question of the week. So it is from somebody in Jim's future home state of Ohio. I'm not quite sure. It'll either be Kentucky or Ohio, but nonetheless, he is an Ohioan. And he writes, "Hi, Jim, Chris, and Bob, and the gang." So he's got everybody in there. "Thank you for educating us on a broad range of retirement topics and all other nuances. I have a question related to the wash sale rule. I have my traditional 401k with Vanguard, all pre-tax, and I plan to roll it into an IRA upon my upcoming retirement. Vanguard says I have to sell all holdings to do that rollover. Am I allowed to buy the same funds in the IRA after the rollover, or does that run afoul of the wash sale rule? It seems like the wash sale rule shouldn't apply to selling assets in a pre-tax 401k, since I have no cost basis. Am I correct? Also, can you go into more depth on the wash sale rule? Maybe provide some examples of what you feel would be substantially identical." He put the word similar, but Chris corrected him. It's identical. "Substantially identical investments versus examples of investments that would perform the same way, but would not be flagged by the IRS as substantially identical?
Nice. Good question. I don't think we've maybe directly covered this. So, Bob, what do you think about the first part of that?
Well, I'll kind of start from the beginning and define what the IRS defines a wash sale loss is. And that is within a 61-day window, which is 30 days before or 30 days after you sell a security, you repurchase the same security, a contract or option to buy that security, or a substantially identical security. What you're doing, or what the way the IRS is kind of looking at this, is when you sell a security or security type investment, a mutual fund, an exchange traded fund, when you sell that, and if you're selling it and realizing a loss, you are realizing a tax benefit. You're earning or obtaining a tax benefit in the form of a tax deduction. And IRS says, that's fine, but we're not going to let you just buy it back right away. And so you're able to earn this loss or have this loss available to use with no risk on your part, no investment risk on your part, just by replacing it. It's just a rule they have in place. They want you to wait outside those 30 days, and then you're absorbing an investment risk that the value of that security goes back up during those 30 days. Then you're able to replace it, and everything is fine. If you run afoul of that wash sale loss rule, meaning you do fall into that definition and within that 30 day before or after, the loss is disallowed. So the loss you just earned, you've lost, and that loss gets added to the basis of the substantially identical or same security that you just repurchased. So that's typically how it works in a taxable event. In this case, this reader is referring to assets within his 401k, which technically, there may be basis in that 401k, but the underlying assets held really don't have basis in the tax basis in the same format as determining a gain or loss, because there are no gain or losses in a 401k. The only way it's taxed is when you take it out. So to answer his question, he is correct. He can sell all those investments, roll the cash over to the new IRA, and buy them all back.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about the wash sale rule when doing transactions inside of retirement accounts, because there's no cap gains or cap losses. It's a different type of, quote, income that's being taxed there. It's kind of apples and oranges almost. You can think of it that way. There's no capital loss event, and there's no capital gain events in transactions revolving inside of typical retirement accounts. So that's kind of the get out of jail free card there. It's what makes rebalancing inside of retirement accounts so clean, is you don't have to worry about gains and losses as you're doing it. Because as you pointed out, Bob, it's the removal of money from the accounts, or removal of assets, doesn't have to be the cash, removal of assets from the retirement accounts that triggers a possible taxable event. And then we're talking about ordinary income recognition rather than cap gains or losses. So it's a good question there. I don't know that we might have touched a little bit on that before. I vaguely remember having maybe one other question in our history that related to this, but not one I think this direct. So I think that was a good one to handle. Anything else, Jim, you want to chime in here, or do you want to talk about the substantially identical thing?
Yeah, I just want to mention a few things. You're correct, and nobody said anything that's not correct. I just want to make sure our listeners understand the nuances. If you are within a 401k like this gentleman is, and he's going to sell, because he has to, 401ks transfer cash. They don't transfer assets. Well, some can. You can do actual transfers out of employer stock when you're doing the NUA benefit, when you're doing that. But for the most part, a 401k will transfer cash. So he's correct. He has to sell that holding. He can then go to his IRA and buy it back for the exact same reasons you guys said. There's no taxable gain or loss being realized in the eyes of the IRS. There may be a loss, but it's not going to give you a tax benefit. So you don't have to worry about it. But don't think you can have a brokerage account and say, oh, I'm going to sell this investment that I'm down on. And as I sell it, I'm going to go to my IRA and I'm going to buy it in there. And I can still be exposed to that asset in case it rebounds in the 30 days I have to wait after I sell it to buy it. And I can skirt the wash sale rule. That doesn't work. They will count assets being purchased in an IRA if they are substantially identical to the asset you sold in your brokerage account. That's something Ed Slott drills into our heads constantly.
Yeah, that's a good nuanced point there that people should be aware of. Yeah.
So when we say you don't have to worry in a 401k or an IRA, true, you don't. If you're going from one IRA to another, or if you're in your IRA and you sold something and the next day you think, oh, heck, I want that. I should have never sold it. You can buy it right back. No big deal. But don't try to cross-pollute, is what I call them. Do it in a brokerage account and then try to make up for it in the IRA and then go back to the brokerage account 31 days later and repurchase it. So do keep that in mind. But let's look at some of the other things he says. Get into a little more depth on the wash sale rule. Bob, why don't you share with our listeners the custodian's responsibility and what they will generally do and how the IRS may pick up on the wash sale rule to begin with?
Well, the custodian makes that judgment call on that definition, which, you know, is a little bit, it's a gray area. The word itself is gray substantially. That doesn't mean anything other than what a high percentage, but what is that high percentage? I don't believe that's been defined. So I know as a preparer, I'm relying on the custodian to figure that out, to define what that means and to track that number. And they do that and they put it on the 1099B that everybody receives from their taxable brokerage account every January, early February. And it shows up. It shows up next to the realized gain, or in this case, the realized loss. We're going to specifically see a realized loss. And then right next to it, there's another number, another column. It says wash sale disallowed. And if there's any of that loss that is disallowed, that custodian reports it on that form. And, you know, all since what, 2012 or something, all of these transactions are now uploaded to the IRS. So they see all that information. And so as a tax preparer, I pull that disallowed loss off the 1099B, and it does go onto your tax return, and it does show up on your Schedule 8949.
Exactly. And that's what makes this so unknown, because substantially identical is not black and white. It's more gray. And it's a gray that is forever moving between black and white. It's really hard to pin down. One man's trash is another man's treasure, as they say. But Chris, you pointed out something that you got from the IRS, if it involves, and here's where it gets a little gray again, because the IRS references specifically mutual funds. And what do they say?
Well, they provided some guidance in the past where just funds at two different mutual funds, even if it's the same style of fund itself, the fact that it's at two different mutual fund companies are not ordinarily considered substantially identical, which seems kind of, you know, strange. But that's where, you know, mutual funds get a little messier than individual securities. It's pretty easy to argue a share of Apple is a share of Apple. They're all identical. They're the same. So being at different custodians or different times of the day, or they're the same. But a mutual fund is a bundle of other securities. and or maybe even other mutual funds. You can have mutual funds of mutual funds. But even if they have the same style generally, or their target or their goal is basically the same between them, they did put out a statement. This is quite a while ago. This is fairly old. This is over a decade, easily. That just being at a different mutual fund company causes there to be enough differences for them not to consider those substantially identical. But again, anytime you know, the IRS uses substantially or ordinarily, that opens the door to something that's an exception and makes, you know, makes me a little nervous. I was kind of pointed out as there's a line in the sand somewhere, but nobody knows exactly where it is. And so if you don't want to cross it, you better not get too close. So just have some caution if you're thinking of engaging in a transaction that might be subjected to the wash sale rule, and not try to push it too hard because, you know, it could be picked up on and then you could face issues there with inappropriate income tax preparation.
Right. And that surprised me when you read that if you got, for instance, and sold the Fidelity Growth Fund and turned around and bought the T. Rowe Price Growth Fund. And I don't even know if those are real funds, folks. I'm just throwing those names out there. The point is the name is in their growth, but from what Chris read, the mere fact that they're at different mutual fund companies, I think the IRS was taking the approach, different managers, perhaps different research staff, different analysts, maybe different measures. So they would go so far as to say, you're okay. But when I was studying, this is going way back now, more than 20 plus years ago, when I was studying at Boston University, I know when they were teaching us about the wash sale rule there, I remember the instructors referencing that if you, and they were using mutual funds as the example, and they said, if you sold a large cap growth and bought a large cap value, in their opinion, they would not be identical, but they never said it was yes or no. It was very gray. They thought it would be okay because growth and value, one could argue, are two totally different strategies. But I remember the gentleman teaching this to us had the list of investments or the top investments or whatever. I don't think it was all of them in a growth fund and in a value fund. And I was sharing before the show with Bob and Chris that the names of some stocks were identical. Not all of them, obviously, but some were. So could the IRS argue it's substantially identical? I think it becomes a gray area. And Bob pointed out something, and certainly I don't want to steal your thunder, Bob, but you mentioned how the custodians are the ones who are deciding this and listing it on the 1099, but they would be clueless if, say, you sold something at Vanguard in a brokerage account, but you went to your Schwab brokerage account and bought the exact same thing. Vanguard isn't going to know that. Vanguard might see that proceeds just being held in cash.
Yeah, no, that's where the, you know, the old honor, basically the honor system kicks in, because outside of the taxpayer or under audit, no, there's not a reporting mechanism to catch that.
Exactly. So, yes, you have to be honored. You have to be truthful and not do that. But the point is, how are they going to catch you? It would only have to come down to an audit. So it's not a perfect scenario here in that. I know. In my practice, most people know we manage assets at a portfolio level. We're very passive. We use passive holdings, and we try to track very specific models: conservative, moderately conservative, moderate, moderately aggressive, and aggressive. And if we need to realize losses, especially this year, one of the things we do, our portfolios are comprised of 19 different holdings. The wash sale rule does not apply to the portfolio as a whole. It applies to each individual security. So if I sold, say, a moderate portfolio, where the average moderate portfolio, at least up to now, I don't know where it's going to end year to date, but up to now could be down around 12, 13, 14% because both equities and fixed income went down this year. So if I sold 19 individual holdings that, as a whole, in my opinion, represent a moderate portfolio, and then in turn around and buy an exchange traded fund, one fund whose goal, if you will, is to assume a moderate amount of risk and maintain a moderate allocation of 60-40, that's not a violation of the wash sale rule. Because each individual holding, no one could look at one holding, gee, Jim, you sold an emerging market bond fund and bought this moderate allocation fund, you violated the wash sale. No, you didn't. And the custodian, and nor does the IRS require the custodian to look at the portfolio as a whole and make sure the allocation as a whole doesn't match the allocation of that, in my example, one ETF that's being purchased. So that's one of the ways we work within it, which I think is perfectly legal. And if anybody disputes that, if anybody feels the IRS is going to look at the portfolio as a whole as well, please let me know. But it's one way, especially when so much of a portfolio is down this year, both equities and bonds. Where do you begin? Well, how about if you just sold it all, throw the baby out with the bathwater, and then bought an allocation fund, and then 31 days later, went back to your well-diversified individual security holding that might equal, on a risk basis, what that ETF is doing. So that's just one of the ways that we kind of work within the rules, and I think we're okay. And you shared with me, Bob, you feel it's okay as well. But again, it's a gray area. Just be careful, tread lightly, and remember that your custodian is looking and will report to the IRS if they feel there was a wash sale rule violation.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No.
That sounds good.
I think that's good.
We did make one mistake on that. That was actually from Georgette, and I think I used he, so that was my bad.
Ah, okay. Oh, yeah, she put in quotation marks, Georgette.
Anyway, oh. I just want to make that little clarification. I just caught that on the end as I was reading through and listening to you. I was like, well, that's actually a Georgette question.
Okay. This one is from, I don't know. They didn't say where they're from. Darn it. Okay. We'll call him George. It's from somewhere in the United States. We don't know where. And he begins, love you guys. Question on timing of Social Security. Oh, so this, Chris, I included this question, Chris, because you like to do a Social Security question on most Q&A shows, and he ends with a tax question. So I thought, oh, perfect. Starts with Social Security, ends with a tax. What better thing to do when Chris and Bob are on the same show?
Perfect.
Love you guys. Question on timing of Social Security claiming. I am 66 this month with a spouse who is 64. And plan on retiring in 1 year. I have $2.1 million in an IRA, $300,000 in a Roth, and farmland valued at $600,000, and a home also valued at $600,000. Estimated annual income need is $160,000 a year. Our gap years, and I think he means the period of time between retirement and Social Security, Chris, our gap year income is $2,500 from a FERS pension. Okay, where's the actual question? Social Security estimates for me $3,600 at my full retirement age and $4,700 a month at age 70. My wife can claim full retirement in 3 years, which would be $1,800 or half of mine. When would it be best to claim? I know this is kind of a very lacking description of his situation, but maybe you can give him a little bit of thought and feedback on his situation.
Well, I'd say, there's different ways to approach the act of, we'll call it optimizing your Social Security claiming strategy. And it really depends on how you view the benefits and how you value Social Security. Here at our firm, we value Social Security as a inflation-adjusted lifetime income source. So it really shines. We really value its protection against what we call longevity risk, which is you outliving your money. So much so that we like to use Social Security as well as any other secure income sources, like the FERS pension, that's the Federal Retirement System pension that he mentioned, to determine or set up a floor for your retirement below which you cannot fall. And that floor in our concept is called the minimum dignity floor. And so the first thing I would say is if you're following kind of our preferred method of funding your retirement expenses, I would first look at your minimum dignity floor size. You said $160,000 in a year of income needed. That's great, but that's total. That's minimum dignity floor and fun. And so you need to identify how much of that is the minimum dignity floor piece if you're following our approach. If you're not following our approach, you know, then you'd assess this differently. But I'm just kind of, since you wrote into us, I'm going to talk to you about the way we would look at this. And once you determine that, and I suspect this is true, because most people that have Social Security of substantial size, like you're mentioning, as well as another inflation-adjusted pension source, which FERS is an example of that, that your minimum dignity floor is likely covered by those two things. And the biggest issue is going to be the claiming timing of his, because it's his benefit that's much larger than his wife's, his benefit that's going to continue on in a survivorship scenario. And it's particularly important in my eyes to make sure that that survivor benefit is as large as possible, because that FERS pension is going to drop in half or even lower, depending on the option that you've chosen. And you want to make sure that you leave behind enough income to protect the minimum dignity floor of your wife. And there's different ways of approaching that, but one of the most powerful tools is to make sure to leave behind enough Social Security and pension income to actually establish that minimum dignity floor protection for her. So I'd look at it like that, and I suspect there's going to be evidence to support you waiting until 70 to claim, because I think with the reduction of FERS likely in half, that the age 70 benefit in combination with that is going to make sense for her. Lots of other ways you could talk to other people that have a difference of opinion about how to approach this. They wouldn't even use the concepts of minimum dignity floor. Their methodology might work perfectly fine, but if you're embracing the way we approach retirement planning, that's how I'd look at it. And I'm not saying for sure that waiting to 70 makes sense, because I don't know your minimum dignity floor size. You need to establish that. But I suspect, having looked at many cases similar to what he's describing here, that he's going to actually like, and more importantly, I think your wife, if she sees the projections that include you waiting to 70, but you being gone, and your Social Security and half of your FERS pension being left behind, she's going to prefer that than less Social Security because you claimed earlier. I'm just guessing that's the case. But as for my opinion, that's what it is. So far, there isn't a tax question, though, Jim.
No. And it ends with a very small reference. And I thought we would just kind of, because it's not a specific question, but it ties into taxes. And it can tie into maybe reducing Social Security waiting to 70 on purpose, not only for the benefits that you said, but for others. Because he writes, any thoughts on Roth conversions? And I'm guessing he meant, Bob, in his situation. And I thought, since you're on the show, you could just kind of share with our listeners that Roth conversions can obviously be used for forward-looking tax planning. And he wants to know, any thoughts on Roth conversions?
Yeah, I looking at the information that was provided to us, I think there's a good chance or a good likelihood that Roth conversions will make sense. To the extent of those conversions, there's some holes in the information that if we were developing a plan, we would want to fill those holes in, or those gaps in. So we have a complete picture. It really takes a complete picture to answer the question as to how far to go with Roth conversions, or how big a Roth conversion should we be looking at. In this case, you know, we're looking about a year away from retirement. So they're going to be, you know, 67 and 65 with a likely drop in income from working in, you know, wages to what may just be a FERS pension and maybe some farm income before Social Security starts, and then before the key age is 72 and RMD start, when we see large jumps in income. And with a couple million dollars in an IRA, there's going to be a large jump in income when he turns 72, or when they're 73 and 72. So in the strategy with looking at these conversions is, does it make sense to create taxable income, create taxes early on a voluntary scale? You're making that election. You don't have to do that in order to save taxes later on in life. And so we would want to see in this particular case, what that income actually drops to. There's farm income. We don't have a number there to really know, you know, where we're at, how much space do we have. That decision on Social Security kind of has to be made. That's going to come into play. A big thing in this case are assets held outside of the IRA that are liquid or somewhat liquid assets, because we're going to need two things, maybe some liquid assets for taxes, for paying taxes. We'd rather do it that way than of course we can take the taxes out of the conversion, but we'd ideally not like to do it that way. So we need some liquid assets to pay the taxes. And then if there's a spending gap, and I think clearly there's going to be a spending gap in those years to come up to that 160,000 spending level, if we're having to pull money out of the IRA to fill that gap, that diminishes what's left to do conversions. So there's some math going on to figure all this out. And then priority wise, they don't mention beneficiaries or children. And you guys talk a lot about it in the financial planning, the two, the one and the zero. Where does that priority lie? And if there's a focus on the two or the one or the zero, or a combination of those two or three, then that's going to adjust the plan, and we're going to make those adjustments to cater or make the best outcome for this couple.
Yeah, that's what was running through my mind, is he doesn't share with us, and which is fine. He didn't know we were going to go down this rabbit hole. But anybody who's contemplating Roth conversions, you should first identify, who are you tax planning for? That's why I call it your tax ordering number. Are you planning for two of you as a couple, one of you as a widow widower, or none of you, zero, as an inheritance most likely to children? 2-1-0. What is that tax ordering number? If the analysis show you don't have an analysis, you didn't talk about doing a retirement projection, but if you had an analysis, and you might see, which is what's running through my head, guys, there could be a widow-widower tax penalty issue the way he's set up right now with $2.1 million in an IRA, and he's still, he's only 66 now, his wife is 64, but he's still 6 years away from any type of RMDs necessarily beginning. But even if he was to die in 10 years or 15 years, and hopefully you live longer than that, listener, but what if you didn't? Your wife could be a widow, excuse me, inheriting and having rather large required minimum distributions that will be pushed through a much smaller tax bracket, a series of brackets. They're smaller. They're about half the size. So you're going to be getting the same amount of income, albeit maybe a little less because of the smaller Social Security goes away. But outside of that, you're only a few years away in age. You're not massively apart in age. So the RMDs are going to be almost identical. especially earlier in retirement, but they're going to be forced through much smaller brackets. So you might have a widow-widower issue. So if you were prioritizing to me the one, the widow or the widower, or the zero, the children, Roth conversions could very well make sense. And that's what's important. Whenever you are asking, should I do Roth conversions, Jim? My first retort back is, who are you planning for? And most people look at me crazy because if they're a couple, they think we're going to be a couple forever. And even Chris, I'm sure you've noticed, even in the analysis you may read on some of the publications that financial planners tend to follow, you might see these long, drawn-out assessments of why this particular couple shouldn't do a conversion. And they set up this whole scheme and then explain that because of this, that, and the other thing, they shouldn't convert. And a lot of times, they never look at the widow or the widower situation. They're just always assuming that the person are going to live as a couple together and die at a ripe old age. We always run an analysis having someone die 5 years into retirement or age 70, whichever one is further away, just to show people what could happen. Anyways, that's what I wanted to share. And the only other thing that I want to add is I would not convert, listener, you don't share with us any of this information, but if you're going to leave money to charity, don't convert those assets. It's a waste. And if you are going to self fund LTC, long-term care needs, I would go so far as to say don't convert those either. And if either one of you want to dispute that, that's fine. I'm just speaking off the top of my mind. Because, Bob, a lot of true long-term care needs, not simply aging-related expenses, AIE, we call them R in the office like a pirate. Aging-related expenses are not long-term care expenses. They are, I want to hire someone to rake my leaves. I want to hire someone to clean the gutters and maybe sweep the house and clean it. I can't do them anymore. I'm getting old. Those are not deductible, but true long-term care needs, where you're in a facility or an assisted living, or you're hiring a true healthcare professional to come take care of you. Those are deductible medical expenses. And to me, since a lot of them will be deductible, depending on whatever the rules are, I think, is it 7.5, Bob, or 10% of AGI now?
They went back to 7.5.
7.5. So they're not fully deductible, but a good portion of them are. If you're going to be able to get a lot of your long-term care needs out of your IRA and deduct them, I question the value of converting them now, unless you are prioritizing the zero. And maybe you want to get this money to a child tax-free. Any thoughts on either of those two?
Yeah, the charity one makes sense for sure. The LTC one, I think odds are that if you're facing significant enough issues to qualify for LTC, that you're having a lot of medical expenses. So
that does work out. The point you made, Jim, about the high medical expenses associated with assisted living and memory care, those dollars are going to be mostly deductible. And so if you're having to go and fund that $10,000 a month and you're having to pull that out of your IRA later, you're going to be able to shelter that for the most part with medical expense deduction.
Whereas a Roth conversion can't be sheltered and you're going to be paying the full tax on it. So that's when I'm chatting with someone, those are the two things that I key on. Don't convert charitable and don't convert reserves for aging. If you're going to be self-funding, then that's just my thoughts. Yeah. Subject to change, depending on what Congress ever does with tax rules.
Right.
Okay, I think we beat that horse to death. Let's move on. We got two more questions I want to get to. It begins, where are they from? Another one who didn't give
HSA
us.
HSA question?
Yes, it's the HSA one. They don't say where they're from. This HSA question, Bob, came in, Chris, in 2021. Remember on the last show, Chris, I found a bunch of HSA questions from 2021. This is the last one that I know of from 2021 that we have not answered. Okay, it begins. If I convert funds from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA in a year that I don't have any W-2 wages, can I still get a deduction for an HSA contribution?
My answer is
yes.
The HSA, for everyone, just as a quick reminder, that's a basically a medical savings account that's individually owned, it's portable. And there's a few requirements to be eligible for that, to fund an HSA. And one of the requirements is not earned income. So, and quickly, the main requirements that are necessary is you have to be covered under a high deductible health plan and not be eligible for any other health plans, nor be enrolled in Medicare. And not claimed as a dependent on somebody else's tax return. So if you qualify for the HSA and you're able to make either single contributions or family contributions, and then there are catch-ups as well with those plans, the key is to have enough income to get a tax benefit for the deduction, because the deduction to fund the HSA is not a medical expense. It does not go on Schedule A, where it's likely lost, right, as itemized deductions. It's a deduction on the front page of your tax return, and it's a deduction to arrive to your adjusted gross income number. And so as long as you have enough income so you're able to deduct the HSA contribution and deduct either standard deduction or itemized deductions, right, whichever one you pick, as long as you're still above zero, so to speak, then there is some tax benefit to contributing to the HSA.
Okay. That's what I thought too. You, Chris?
Yeah, and I think that's a misconception a lot of people have, because they kind of combine HSAs into the world of IRAs, and everyone's been taught appropriately that you have to have earned income in order to make a contribution to an IRA. That does not apply, as you mentioned. There is no income required to make an HSA contribution. There are rules behind who can make an HSA contribution, but having earned income is not one of those rules. You don't have to have income of any kind. Income has nothing to do with it as far as the qualification to contribute to an HSA. So, this one's actually pretty straightforward.
Yep. So I guess if you had, in this case, just hypothetically, if that was the only source of income that year was the Roth conversion, mm-hmm. And if you were married with the standard deduction and a maximum HSA contribution, you would be able to convert about $37,000 tax-free.
Yeah, that's true. So many people, you're right, Chris, confuse, because we're all used to the income limits, or being able to even contribute to an IRA requires earned income. Mm-hmm. But to be able to deduct an HSA contribution, having earned income isn't one of the requirements. Having a high deductible healthcare plan that qualifies as an HSA plan is the most important.
Right.
Okay. Last question. From the good state of, wow, people are being stateless today. They're not telling us where they're from. Gave us his real name, but we're going to call him George. Again, lives in one of the 50 states, we assume. Could be an out-of-country listener. We don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Hi, guys. Just not even identifying us. We're just guys. Hi, guys. I enjoy listening to your podcast. Here is my question. I've been listening to you for the better part of 2 years, and I don't remember if this has ever came up for discussion. In 2021, do you have any idea why he would put CY in front of the year 2020?
That means calendar year.
Calendar year. You've been trying to trick me. In 2021, my parents, age 81 and 79, residents of God's country. He did give the state. I apologize. Anybody want to guess God's country?
Colorado.
Well, that's Colorado is called God's country quite a bit. Pete, what do you think? Chris, what do you think?
Pete thinks it's Oklahoma.
Who, you? Did you say?
No, Pete does.
Pete?
You called out Pete.
Pete's from Missouri.
I know, but he thinks Oklahoma's God's country. I'm just guessing. I don't know. Isn't that a country song
Pete's
or something?
Pete's not here, so I don't know. Okay. God's country to him, and I question his definition of God's country, folks. New Jersey.
Oh, the Garden State.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, I know it's called the Garden State, but Northern New Jersey. Yeah, that's not too cool, but I've driven through New Jersey. The southern part of it is pretty, and it is a garden land. But God's country, New Jersey,
that
folks.
Sounds that's like your Massachusetts bias coming out.
Yeah, we're mess holes. I told you that.
I'm neutral. I don't have any preference for Massachusetts over New Jersey. I think New Jersey is just as nice as Massachusetts.
All right. Well, thank you. All right. Anyways, my parents, age 81 and 79, residents of God's country, New Jersey, converted $110,000 in a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA and paid federal and state taxes. Fast forward now to November of 2022, when they received a letter from Social Security.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. They were expecting to get an 8.7% increase in their monthly Social Security payments. But to their surprise, they were informed that not only are they not getting the increase, but their existing monthly benefit will be reduced by $450 a month due to the IRMA specifically associated with their Roth conversion. So herein lies the dilemma. Is there a way, though, hopefully simple, to recharacterize their Roth IRA conversion back to a traditional IRA, refile the 2022 federal and state tax return to get a tax refund because of the recharacterization, and then contact Social Security and request that my parents' monthly benefits be reinstated to what they expected them to be. Oh, wouldn't that be so sweet if they could do it?
And here's a legitimate reason why Roth recharacterizations would be helpful to people who make such mistakes.
Right. But, well, Chris already bursted your balloon there. No, well, you told them the truth. They can't do it. You could have.
No, I didn't.
Had they done this before 2015? But after 2015, recharacterizations went the way of the dodo bird. But Bob, why don't you? So we're sorry, listener, there's nothing your parents can do. I've got two questions. First, I would like maybe Bob or second, Chris can go first, to kind of explain how you factor and how listeners need to consider Roth conversions beyond just the taxes they're going to owe on it. There's all these other issues, the taxation of Social Security, the IRMA limits, maybe pushing you into NIT, things like that. And Chris, what made me scratch my head, how come they're not going to get the 8.7% COLA adjustment? I didn't know that. IRMA somehow,
no,
the Roth
no,
conversion?
They misdescribed this. They're just saying the IRMA was so large that despite the 8.7% increase, it still caused their net benefit to be lower than what it was this year. They absolutely are going to get the cost of living adjustment of 8.7%, but once they factored in IRMA, their net take home, what's going to be deposited in their account every month, is going down, and that's what they're freaking out about, justifiably. I totally understand that.
Okay, so, I was under the impression, okay, perfect. That makes sense.
I agree.
More
the way he worded it, as I heard that, I'm like, wait a minute, they're going to get that. You're just seeing such a big IRMA offset that it looks like you know, you're, it's, they're taking it away. They're not taking it away. They're increasing your benefit. And then they're saying, well, your Medicare premiums are going to be this. So the net you get in your bank every month will be this. And it's lower than before because of Irma. So, yeah, that's the bummer part and something that has to be considered here. There's no get out of jail free card anymore. Even if there were, issues as far as the timing of our response, but it doesn't really matter because even had we answered this before October 15th of this year, it still would have been too darn late, because it's not allowed. It's too late because you haven't been able to do this since 2015 because they went after people doing loopholes when in fact there's legitimate reasons for recharacterizations. Them constructing such a confusing and convoluted tax code, Medicare rules, all this kind of stuff leads normal Americans to make simple mistakes reasonably. And this, you know, inability to do a Roth recharacterization on a conversion takes away the ability to fix these simple mistakes and is costing these folks thousands of dollars. Now, the good news, and I'll turn this over to Bob so we can comment on what Jim asked, which is kind of what, how do you look at all these factors when you do a Roth conversion? But it's a 1 year event. It hasn't pushed them into this situation permanently, but for 2023, they're going to be paying higher Medicare premiums that are based on their 2021 taxes. And no, none of this qualifies as a life-changing event. This was something they raised their hand and voluntarily did. And the Social Security, Medicare, IRS as a team aren't going to look at that and say, oh, that's a life-changing event kind of outside of your control. So we're going to forgive you and let you off the hook for Irma. This isn't going to qualify. This is something you raised your hand to do. Now regret it, understandably. But you're not going to get forgiveness for something that you voluntarily decided to do. Just like when you voluntarily sell a rental property. A lot of people think that one of the life-changing events that says loss of income-producing property means if you sell your rental, that's qualifies. It does not, because you raised your hand and voluntarily did it. If you lost your rental property because a hurricane destroyed it, that qualifies as a life-changing event, not you voluntarily doing it. So with those comments, I'll turn it over to Bob to talk about how he kind of brings all these pieces together to decide if a Roth conversion makes sense.
Well, fortunately, you know, we have the software and that kind of helps us with this because there's a lot of moving pieces. And you know, Jim was mentioning, you know, there's the NIT tax, which is a 3.8% investment income tax that's at a certain income threshold. Of course, all these IRMA brackets when you're, you know, basically 63 and older, you're likely to be being looked at. So there's IRMA brackets to figure in. There's ordinary income tax brackets. There's capital gains tax brackets, right? They kind of run a little differently. And so, there's probably four, five, six different things that are coming into play. And so it takes the software and a forward-looking approach to know which of those thresholds you want to stay under and which ones still make sense to go over. And does it make sense to go over one, two, you know, different quantities? And that's just a numbers game with everything that's involved. And it's just a very complicated picture. And so that's what we would rely on to know where to go with a conversion or how to measure that conversion. I will say a couple things. That's a nasty hit. It, like Chris said, it is only for 1 year. It's not for life. That would be absolutely detrimental. It is for 1 year, so it can be measured. And in this case, it's probably be about a $6,000 hit. It's more than the 450 because the 450 is inclusive of that 8.7% that's in there as well. So the actual hit's more than 450 a month is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
That's about a 6% cost for that conversion, right? About 6%. In some cases that actually may make sense. In some cases, it may not make sense, and maybe that's this case. I don't know without all the other information. But if if paying that 6.6% in 1 year reduced Irma for the next 15 years, that may be a good thing. And that may be something the software would tell us is a good thing. So it's not like 100% categorically a bad idea. Mm-hmm. You just have to look at every specific case and situation. So it's likely to be kind of painful for them, but maybe not. I mean, when you measure it in finite terms, it's measurable, and you can decide if that was a good idea or not. You certainly can't fix it. And I would just, on the outside chance for these folks, if 2021, if there was a qualifying event for them that year, they could file the form SSA 44 and get out of that hit this year.
True. We didn't, they don't mention it, but if there is one, so take a look at the list of qualifying or life altering events. Now I'm on the tip of my tongue, the actual wording is off, but, take a look at that list that's on there and see if one of those may apply to you. Life-changing event. And if you're lucky, it does. If you're lucky, it actually does. So take a look for 2021, 2022, and see if a life-changing event might give you some relief. But 2021 is the target year that we're talking about here, where they had that big spike in income because of the Roth conversion. Take a look at that. And there's, I think, 7 listed on there. So people who aren't familiar with it, if you just Google SSA-44, use the search tool of your preference. But marriage, divorce, death of a spouse, work stoppage, work reduction, loss of income producing property, loss of pension income, employer settlement. Now at their ages, 79 and 81, I suspect it's not likely any of those things have happened. But just in case. Just in case, take a look at that and see.
Okay. Yep, go ahead, Bob.
No, I was going to say that's kind of how I would look at that for right now. And, worst case is you weather the storm for the 1 year. You did get some money into a Roth account that's going to, grow tax-free. There's some hidden benefits in there. So kind of look at it that way. And just the term that recharacterization, that's gone away from doing Roth conversions, right? But there are still recharacterizations out there in a sense that if you were to contribute to a Roth account during the year and then realize you made too much money, you still can recharacterize that contribution as a traditional IRA contribution or traditional IRA non-deductible contribution. So there are still some recharacterizations going on,
right,
but not the Roth conversion ones.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's recharacterizations being dead is just for Roth conversions, not for other types of retirement plan recharacterizations.
Right. And I just wanted to reiterate what Bob was picking up on, because that's the only thing that was running through my mind. A large dollar amount was converted, folks, $110,000. I don't think that was randomly chosen. I think some forethought went into it, perhaps not as much forethought as Bob would recommend people do. But there has to have been a reason why they converted that and a benefit to the conversion. So don't lose sight of that. Don't lose sight of the fact that you're going to have to pay this Irma penalty for a year, or your parents are going to have to pay it for a year. Don't lose sight of that, because there is going to be a bigger benefit somewhere buried in there. That was the biggest thing that I wanted to harp on.
Yep. Wish we had better news for them. This is a prime example of why they should not have just blanket eliminated Roth conversion recharacterizations.
Well, we were against that when that happened from the get-go.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And it was under the Obama administration. We're not throwing any political party under the bus, but they described it as a loophole. And what irked the heck out of Chris and I, it wasn't a loophole. It was the law. The law allowed recharacterizations. And as they described the reason why they were getting rid of it, and the reason they got rid of it, folks, it was the best type of tax increase ever. It was a tax increase that didn't look like a tax increase. They could pawn it off by pointing out one or two or three unique cases, and they did, situations where people were gaming the system. And Chris and I aren't saying some people didn't game the system. Maybe tweak the law a little to keep that gaming from happening. But they key in on a few things and then say we're getting rid of it for everyone. They got rid of the ability to do Roth conversions for recharacterizations for this very reason. They don't want people who got nailed, most likely with higher taxes, into getting out from it. So it was a way that they could increase revenue, maintain higher revenue, without actually saying to people, we're going to raise your taxes. And that's exactly what it was, though, as a revenue generator. It's the same thing you and I, Chris, talked about repeatedly with the stretch IRA. Long before Secure Act passed, I had been and Chris had agreed that the stretch IRA was going to go the way of the dodo bird someday because it was the easiest way. It's the best tax increase. It doesn't look like one. It's a Trojan horse. It looks like a little plaything. And it's full of bad stuff. And that's what Secure Act was. It looked really nice with the few good things they did in it, but it was a massive tax increase because it's going to force your IRAs out in 10 years. The only thing that you and I were wrong on, Chris, we thought they were going to bring back the five-year rule.
Yeah.
Which is the way it always was. They brought back the 10-year rule. But mark my words, sometime, and no time soon, and it won't be over my remaining working career even, but I think at some point over my lifetime, that 10-year rule is going to become a five-year rule. And they can easily get away with it by saying, well, that's the way it always was. Or they'll find some other quote-unquote loophole. Or they'll just be honest. We need the revenue. So we're going down to 5 years. It just keep that all in mind. The ability to do recharacterizations was not a loophole. It was to help people just like this person's mom and dad. And unfortunately, you can't fix it.
Yep. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening in on another Retirement and IRA show, this Q&A version of a EDU show. Thanks a lot, Bob, for coming in. That'll probably be the last show we'll have you on for this year, so have a happy ending to your 20. I'm sure we're going to talk. You just won't be on the show. So, we'll gather some more tax questions. And since we know the beginning part of January is a little bit quiet for tax folks, if you're around, maybe we'll get you in to do another set of tax questions at that time. So you all out there listening, if you have tax heavy questions, send those in to us. Best way to send in questions for the show, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. The subject line, put in there, it's a question for the podcast. He can add them to his pile. Jim, glad to hear your AFib has gone dormant, at least for now.
7 days, hopefully 7 days dormant.
So that continues. So
I don't know. I don't know if that gets me out of having to do the operation or not, but yeah. I will find out.
That'd be nice.
And,
so
yeah. And Bob, I'm glad that you'll be able to come back on the show next year. I was thinking maybe dedicating like maybe the entire month of March, April to just tax stuff with you or tax shows. And I mean, you got a lot of free time then, right?
Yeah. Somewhere. That's actually the best time.
Yeah, best time for you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he's yeah, deep into it. Time, it's yeah. top of mind. Yeah, sounds like
exactly. a, yeah. Well, that sounds like a actually great that part is true.
Yeah, I know.
The rest of it's not so true. No, I appreciate you guys having me on today. Going through these questions, it's always fun to talk about. I'm not a big fan of that game show part, but you know, the rest of it was great.
Yeah, yeah, but Bob, you hold the game show record. You get the highest score.
Oh, you are the champion, but we're going to let him retire. We're going to retire the whole.
You are the champion of the world.
I wouldn't bet. I'll go out on top. I like that.
No, I've got more words. I mean, it's if for some reason Microsoft stinks. I mean, it cannot. I talk into it and it comes out with all sorts of weird, crazy things. Since Chris isn't going to play again, I've got to just ask this one then. Can you guys have any idea what Microsoft was thinking when it typed, call Jason again?
No, that sounds good.
Yeah. Did you call Jason?
So you kind of have to mumble it all together as if it was one word.
Call Jason.
It was. I said clearly and articulately.
Just like now?
Correct. Just like that?
Yeah.
To Microsoft, I was trying to say cognitive.
That's not even a word, but that's probably why it struggled a little bit.
Cognitive? It is a word. It's your brain.
Oh, well, yeah. Cognitive is. Cognitive is not.
Cognitive. There's an N in there. It's a cognitive.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go.
That's it.
Cognitive. It typed call Jason again.
Wow. Nice. Well, it's a better interpretation than I had. Although, you think with that, again, they need to use the context of what you're saying to see if, because I'm sure the words around it would help give somebody or a computer a clue as to what the heck you were saying. But
I don't know if it looks at context. I thought it just looked at it.
It must not. But there's technology now that does. There's some AI-based stuff, and it listens and also pays attention to what you're saying and will correct a lot of that stuff for you. Maybe we need to upgrade you from Microsoft for your voice to text.
True. It comes with Word, though. It's so convenient.
There's some amazing new stuff out there. So
press the little microphone in Word, and it lets you go. But anyways, I do appreciate, Bob, you playing. And Chris, I got a couple of more easy ones. You'll nail the next one. Just trust me. Call Jason again was the last hard one. The next, if you can't guess these next ones, you they're as easy as Sue's hen.
Great. Okay, I look forward to it.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to listen to the next show now.
Oh, great!
Just to hear that game show has been put to rest.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll be back to you next week with a brand new show. Bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.